forever. Dog.
Comic books, comic time. Writers and artists are on the line. They make a splash as a comic's read and take us on a trip behind the spread. Watch out for comic book commentary. Spinning a winning inside fix, how they got a hot idea. Narrative, character, visual tricks, and onomatopoeia. It's comic book commentary.
Finally, Jeremy Whitley has returned to the comic book commentary, a podcast.
Yeah, I'm gonna drop the whole bit. It's really fun for me. I think maybe not that fun to listen to, though. All right. Hey, guys. Jeremy Whitley back here again to talk about comic books and give you sort of a behind-the-scenes insight into what it even is I think I'm doing. You may have heard me talking about Unstoppable Wasp before. Today, it's going to be something a little lighter. We're talking about the Future Foundation. And because of the sort of the nature of the story, Ben asked me to do a track on number one, and there were so many little spoilery things that I wasn't going to be able to talk about that I asked to have him hold on to do it until number two came out. And we're going to do just one big track that covers both Future Foundation number one and two, but also the backup that our team did in Fantastic Four number 12, which was sort of the soft launch of the series. So I'm going to talk about all of that on here. I'm going to try not to run too obnoxiously long. But I did want to make sure that you guys had all the information so I wouldn't be spoiling things here. So do read those comics before you listen to this if you have any interest in reading those comics, because, you know, I'm going to spoil stuff. I'm going to go through everything. So fair warning, I'm going to give you a few seconds to shut off that device that you're listening to the podcast on, and then we'll get started. Ready? All right. So before I dive too deep into the story itself, I want to make sure that we talk about everybody that's involved in making this book, because that's the real behind the scenes of this. Obviously, I'm the writer on the Future Foundation. Will Robson is the primary artist. There are a few pages in here that are penciled by Paco Diaz. That'll be in issue two. There's the first couple of pages are penciled by Paco. Both of those guys are fantastic. There's quite a bit of inking and finish assists by Danielle Orlandini on Will's stuff, and coloring by Greg Menzi. On Paco's stuff, there are colors by Chris O'Halloran. The whole thing, Fantastic Four and Future Foundation, is lettered by the extremely talented Joe Caramagna, who always makes me look like a better writer than I am, because things actually fit in the page, whether or not they actually should. The Fantastic Four story in 12, which I'm not going to talk about in any kind of detail because I didn't write it. But if you're looking at that issue, it's written by Dan Slott, drawn by Sean Izaxi, colored by Marcio Menez, and that issue has a great cover by Isad Ribic. If you didn't read that, you really should. It's good. Also, these issues, Future Foundation, have covers of the work by Carlos Pacheco, Rafael Fontariz, Matt Lackey, Humberto Ramos, Edgar Delgado, Nick Bradshaw, Rochelle Rosenberg, John Tyler Christopher, Takeshi Miyazawa, and Ian Herring. Also, this series is edited by Sarah Brunstad and Tom Brevoort, with some help from C.B. Cebulski, who is the editor-in-chief at Marvel. You're going to hear me talk about Sarah and Tom at various points. That's who I'm talking about. I might even say C.B.'s name again. Hi, C.B. All right. That's all the creative folks out of the way. Quick note, if you're not familiar with the Future Foundation, That's fine because they haven't been in all that many comics. They were created by Jonathan Hickman in his run on Fantastic Four from a few years back, which is, if you haven't heard somebody who loves comic books rant about how great the Jonathan Hickman Fantastic Four is, you haven't talked to them very long because it's very good. He has a whole run of Fantastic Four. At one point, there's a big event and it switches over to being Future Foundation, which is when most of these characters are introduced. There is also a significant run after that by Fraction and the All Reds, which is really fantastic. And you guys should definitely check out as well. They also do appear in the first few issues of Dan Slott's Fantastic Four before they spiral off to go do what they're doing in this comic. So you can check all those things out. I recommend all of them. They're really great. But let me give you kind of a breakdown of who we'll be looking at in this comic, because they come from sort of all over creation. So Alex Power is the first person we're going to hear from in this series. He is the leader of the Future Foundation. He was put in charge by Reed Richards back during Fantastic Four, when the Fantastic Four went back to Earth and the FF went on their own mission. Alex is one of the original four members of the Power Pack, the, you know, first Marvel Kids team, along with his sisters, Katie and Julie, and his brother, Jack. Katie and Jack don't appear in this series. They're back on Earth doing kid things still, presumably. But Alex was, recruited as sort of the oldest member of the Future Foundation to begin with, and was eventually left in charge of it. Alex deal, beyond being smart, like everybody in this series is that he controls gravity. He can make gravity become stronger or weaker in pockets. He can use it to do all sorts of fun things. We're also going to see Julie in this series. She's going to be, you know, the second one sort of narrating this first story. Both Alex or Julie's thing is she's super fast and can fly. Both Alex and Julie have sort of long histories in the Marvel Universe with multiple teams. Alex was on the New Warriors between doing Power Pack and doing Future Foundation. Julie has been in the Loners, which were sort of a non-team team, and also was in Avengers Academy. And before this, her last appearance was in Runaways, where she had a breakup with her long-term girlfriend, Carolina Dean, which we're going to talk about a little bit in this story because it's kind of relevant to the introduction here. You're also going to see Dragon Man, who is a former Fantastic Four villain turned hero. He's neither a dragon nor a man. He's an android. He's very smart, very kind, loves these children. He's also a giant android dragon that breathes fire. So there's that. Bentley 23 is maybe my favorite. He's a little jerk. He's a clone of the Wizard, who is one of the classic Fantastic Four villains. Like the Wizard, he is a super genius scientist and inventor. Like the Wizard, he's also a jerk. Unlike the Wizard, he's mostly a good guy, other than that he just really, really enjoys tormenting Alex. Onome was a character that was created for the Future Foundation by Jonathan Hickman. She is a young Wakandan engineering prodigy that got picked up as part of the Future Foundation. She like Donatello, does machines. She doesn't have a power beyond that, but she's really, really good at that. The other characters you might know, even if you've never picked up a Future Foundation comic in your life, are Artie and Leech, young mutant Moppets who originate, you know, all the way back in the Morlocks and X-Men. Artie projects things from his mind, holograms, basically. Leech shuts off people's powers. And then You have the Moloids, who are Tong, Torg, Mick, and Kor. They're all super advanced, super intelligent descendants of mole people from the Fantastic Four. And then we also have the Uhari villain Wu, who are sort of the prince and princess of this other underwater kingdom that's not Namor and Atlantis and all that. They're sort of a rival kingdom. They're used kind of sparingly in this, mostly because I don't have a lot of call for underwater action for the most part. But they are there. So the cool thing about the Future Foundation to me, this has felt a lot like the Wasp in this regard too, is that it's a team of young kids, but they are so intricately tied into the Marvel universe. I mean, you've got obviously, you know, ties to the Power Pack, the Loners, Avengers Academy, New Warriors, Runaways, X-Men, Morlocks, Black Panther, the Wizard, obviously Fantastic Four. And then once we get to issue one, there's a bit of a connection to Guardians of the Galaxy that we'll talk a little bit about as well. But let's jump in with Fantastic Four issue 12. We're looking at page 27, which is the beginning of Maya and Will's first Future Foundation story, which is called Speed of Light. You'll notice in the bottom of this first panel that the name of the asteroid they're on here is 1984 JA. Asteroids are traditionally named by the year and the month and date that they were found. This name corresponds to an asteroid that would have been discovered at the same time that the Power Pack was launched. So a little Easter egg for you there. Nobody's quite mentioned. this is... You get a little bit of a recap at the beginning here from Alex, who is running for his life along with the rest of the Future Foundation. They're being chased through this asteroid by mostly unseen, evil, scarily toothed aliens. You get a quick look at everybody. You get a quick snipe from Bentley, because of course you do. The first spoken sentence in this whole thing is, "Congratulations, Power, you finally got us all killed," which I feel like is maybe the mission statement for this comic in a way. You get a little bit of Tong right here off the bat, our young trans female Moloid, who I know is a lot of folks' favorite character in the Future Foundation. I can't even say that I have a favorite Future Foundation character anymore, because I love them all so much. I want only good things for all of them, except maybe Bentley. I want equally good and bad things for him. So we're getting a little of run dialogue. Everybody's trying to get away from these creatures. The creatures won't come into the light, so they're using this light to ward them off. But they only have so much light to spare. And as this first page ends, Alex sort of collapses the tunnel behind them using his gravity ability to buy them some time so they can figure out a way out of here. And of course, it ends with a sort of predictive, Julie, I'm sure, is doing great back at home. Everything's probably fine there. And of course, the next page, we find out that Julie is not, in fact, doing well. This was an important scene to me that it's sort of been in there since the beginning, because I knew I wanted to use Julie, because even though she's not a member of the previously existing Future Foundation, she has this tie to Alex and to the whole legacy of the Power Pack, which so does Alex. They both have this very similar thing of having been brought up, having been superheroes as kids, and really expecting a lot of themselves in a way that, you know, probably isn't fair to them. You know, Alex is experiencing this sort of moment of panic, of not being able to handle being the leader of the Future Foundation. And Julie is experiencing this moment of personal failure. You know, because Julie is a character who, you know, in the Power Pack was sort of the smarter, level-headed older sister, right? Like, she is sort of the, you know, mom too, in a lot of ways. You know, she was the well-read one, one who had things taken care of. That's a depiction that I think has changed a little bit in the last couple of years, and that, especially in The Loners, she's shown, you know, having run off to LA and, trying to start an acting career. And then, you know, in Avengers Academy, we learn a lot more about her, including that she comes out as bisexual, and this is going to be something that, like, some people have had issues with online, and have talked to me about as well, is she definitely defines herself and her sexuality in Avengers Academy. And she defines herself as, she says she is bisexual, even though the description of her bisexuality that she gives sounds a lot like she's pan, which, you know, I think has a lot to do with just sort of the changing of the time and evolution of how we think about sexuality. I mean, you know, that's still, we're still talking about 10 years ago when Avengers Academy came out. So it's a little dicey, but, you know, last time we heard from her, she has called herself bisexual. So that's kind of what I stuck with as far as the way she actually talks about herself. And what we learned from this page is not only, last time we saw her, she broke up with Carolina, because they are kind of incompatible in the way they think about life and superheroing and everything. You know, Julie, having been somebody who was on a superhero team with, like, her younger brother and sister, and who, you know, takes superheroing very seriously, and Caroline and the Runaways being not really superheroes, but kids with superpowers who occasionally stumble into doing heroic things, but whose, you know, time and legacy as superheroes has been more about surviving and self-determination than superheroism. Julie finds that, like, fundamentally incompatible, which I think makes a lot of sense for that character. I know a lot of people are not overly fond of that breakup. I think it makes sense in the way it was done. Anyway, we find out here that Julie has not actually been doing well. That she has found out after this, you know, breakup, that her girlfriend at the time bounced back much more quickly than she did, and she finds herself pretty broken up about the aftermath of this breakup, and that has resulted in her getting depressed, not going to class, slowly flunking out of college, and then, you know, sort of coming to this moment of, like, she's not a superhero anymore. She's not a college student anymore. All these things that she defines herself by have kind of fallen to the wayside for her, and she doesn't know what to do. She's depressed and she's worried, and she, you know, at the end is really thinking about Alex, who used to be the team leader and excelled at doing speeches, and she's talking about how much she feels like she needs one of those a team leader get up and go kind of speeches to get out of this sort of disgusting funk that she's in, where she's sort of been on the couch for extended period of time and has, you know, just food and junk everywhere. Which, man, having gone to college and having had roommates who went through their own stuff, it's maybe the realest thing I feel like I've ever written in a comic. So we get back to our kids on the asteroid. They've come up with a plan. It's important to me coming out of Wasp to have characters that have, you know, sort of specialties within the science thing. Bentley is sort of chaos scientist. He just does crazy stuff. But Anome builds things, fixes things. Tong is doing programming here. So they've taken what they have, which in this case is some of, you know, Dragon Man's machinery and subroutines, and programmed him to be able to teleport. And Tong has written this big sort of program for them, this algorithm, which is supposed to be able to have Dragon Man teleport a person with him to find a person to help them. So the algorithm is supposed to be able to help them find the best possible person to help them with the issue they're asking for help with. So Alex decides he's going to go. Bentley at first is championing himself as a possible option. But then when he discovers there's a chance that he'll end up being teleported into the middle of space, he is more than happy to let Alex go instead. So Alex grabs onto Dragon Man, and they jump out and pop up in, of course, the middle of Julie's college apartment here. And we get a nice little reunion between Alex and Julie, who haven't seen each other in years because Alex has been off at the Future Foundation. Has aged up several years faster than Julie because of having been sort of outside of space and time for quite a while. And you get like a nice emotional, but instantly sort of this siblings who know each other moment that is what I really wanted to capture. Like, you know, they're very excited to see each other. There's a big hug, and immediately first thing Alex says to her is that, you know, she smells, which almost certainly she does. And then Julie makes fun of his terrible facial hair, which having been that kid in college who, you know, is trying to grow in the facial hair very unsuccessfully with just patches here and there, I feel like it's a very real moment in a superhero world. Like, oh yeah, Alex can control gravity, but he can't control his own facial hair. Dragon Man is anxious to get back and save the kids, and sort of without really getting her consent to do so, Alex grabs Julie and teleports her out to the middle of space. Julie, of course, is not thrilled because she's wearing a hoodie and athletic shorts, and specifically, she says no bra, which is a weird way to find yourself in the middle of space. They have this moment of yelling back and forth, and of course they're interrupted by Bentley, who just takes the opportunity to snipe even further. But of course, Julie's grown up with two very aggravating brothers, and she knows how to handle herself. Tells Bentley off, and lists all the horrible things that have happened to her. But she knows that she can save the day. She is the perfect person to deal with this, because these creatures are photophobic and they are very lost in these tunnels. Julie is very, you know, can move at the speed of light, so she can move through the tunnels very quickly. And she creates, as we're about to see in this big spread page, Julie creates a sort of rainbow trail of light when she moves. So the creatures stay away from her. She's able to find her way out and get all of the kids out without too much issue, and within a matter of seconds, we see her, you know, really come back to being the superhero that she always is and always knows she is. She has been depressed and has had a hard time, but she also she's also still Lightspeed. She's still Julie deep down. And this is sort of the first time we get to see Julie smile or be happy. And the Julie herself has been happy in a while. Including Bentley tries to show her up by mentioning that there's no way that she's going to be able to get Dragon Man out of the asteroid. He's much too heavy, much too big. And she points out that he should be smart enough to know that weight isn't a constant. It's a function of gravity. Science. And, you know, uses Alex's power to help get them out. And she is immediately beloved by the young kids and does what I assume it has to be how Julie enters the room at any party, that sort of slide rainbow into the room. At least in my head, that's how it works. And they head back to the ship and get off of this asteroid before they have to deal with any more of these creatures. We pick up on the next page later that night, and Alex is reminiscing about the days in the Power Pack and looking at his old photos of the four of them together. Julie arrives, having recently had a makeover. She's got just a huge amount of eyeliner all around her eyes from having let the kids have a whack at her. And she kind of lays everything out for Alex of, like, everything that's happened to her since the last time they talked and the kind of tough time she's had. And she's convinced Alex is going to yell at her and let her have it and really give her some crap about it. But Alex is a good guy and a good brother. And gives her what she really needs is, you know, a hug and something to do. Gives her a purpose to, you know, get her up off that couch and doing something she cares about. She wants to join the Future Foundation and help teach these kids and be part of all this. So she decides to join up. He's excited to have her and not have all this pressure on himself anymore and actually, you know, have somebody that he can depend on. He promises to give her anything she wants. And of course, the only possible response to this is that he needs to shave his facial hair because it's awful. It's going to be sort of our ongoing joke about Alex's awful facial hair. Somebody online was very upset about his facial hair and wanted us to stop drawing it in the issues. And I was like, no, that is very specifically in my script because every guy that's ever grown a beard or wanted to grow a beard has at some point had horrible facial hair as they tried to figure that out. And that's really the moment in Alex's life I want to capture is that sort of trying to be the adult in the room, even if that means, you know, growing in a really awful clump of facial hair. He's so desperate to be, you know, the Reed Richards to these kids, and he feels like he's failing. He really gives us a chance for him to sort of wear that on his face, literally. I think little things like that you can do with characters' appearances are so important in comics that you can tell bits of story without having to, you know, really say them out loud about, you know, who these characters are and what they're dealing with. Well, that wraps up the Fantastic Four backup. And so we're going to jump over into Future Foundation number one. I gave you all the teams already, so jump in and immediately meet our new guest professor for this story. There was originally a short story that I wrote that... to give you a little more behind the scenes, this is the first bit of Future Foundation I wrote, is Future Foundation number one. With the knowledge that we were planning to go back and do the backup story in Fantastic Four. And originally, the story that I ended up writing for the backup for Fantastic Four first was about the recruiting of Yondu. we hear a little bit about Julie being recruited secondhand, and it was something I wanted to go back and cover in more detail later. But it's important to me that we jump in the first issue of Future Foundation with everything going. So I was going to tell the story about Julie and Dragon Man going to recruit Yondu, who was, of course, in the middle of a horrible backwater planet, in the getting caught up in a gunfight when he was trying to steal and sell stolen goods. Dragon Man teleporting Julie to him out there in the middle of nowhere. Him agreeing to come and join the Future Foundation, which it's interesting in that, we'll get to it later at some point, but, the original pitch for this story, for the series for Future Foundation was that we have a series of guest professors in the story to come in and teach. And the deal is, these kids are some of the smartest kids in the universe. They've been all around the multiverse. They've helped recreate worlds. So there's no one teacher who can replace Reed and Sue. And there's no person who has enough knowledge to teach all of them. So the idea would be that anytime the Future Foundation runs into something that they don't know how to do or something that they want to learn, that they would use this Dragon Man's ability to teleport to find that person who's best able to help them do the thing that they want to do. So we'll see some of that, some of Yondu's story of recruiting, I think probably in issues 4 or 5. But it was important to me that we sort of jump in headfirst to this story. So it starts with Yondu pretending to walk Julie into this sort of private prison on this isolated planet in the middle of nowhere. It's a, crystal planet. There's nowhere to escape to. So it's a great place to have people locked up because it's inhospitable. If you were to break out of prison, you would need a way off world immediately to actually escape. Otherwise they would just track you down. There's nowhere to go. The idea is that it's a private prison. So anybody that has a bounty on them can be brought here for, some amount of that bounty, and they will then resell them to whoever placed the bounty. In this case, Yondu is taking Julie in for this bounty. And, this is a place that Yondu has been before, obviously, because Yondu's been to all the space prisons at some point. We get a little talk back and forth about the shampoo that Julie used and the fact that Julie has several bounties out on her in space because, of course, the Power Pack, was at war with, fought the Snarks for quite a while, who were, weird insect-like aliens, and various points were helped by and fought the Chimelians, who were weird horse-like aliens, who are the enemies of the Snarks. So we find out that Julie's got several bounties out, some of which are dead or alive, which really bothers Julie. Because, this is an interesting scene for me because there's this sort of the mission is get Julie into the prison so that she can figure out, where this person is that they're looking for or what this thing is that they're looking for and get them out. The thing is, that's not what either of them are doing in this scene. Yondu is fighting about the price for Julie because he knows she's worth more than what they're trying to give him. Even though it doesn't actually matter. He has no intention of leaving her there. He's just sneaking her. He's just, using the sales way to get her in. He is incensed by their desire to be cheapskates. So is arguing the price with her. Julie, in the meanwhile, is very upset that somebody wants her dead and is trying to find out who has a bounty out on her because she fancies herself good and decent person doesn't understand why anybody would want her dead. I feel like we'd all have that reaction to some extent, but they're both sort of like ignoring their actual mission, which is getting her in as easily as possible. So we follow Yondu back out of the prison, and we meet the rest of the team in there constructing stuff in the main part of the ship. They're all putting together these computers as part of the plan. We don't know exactly what the plan is, but we know it has something to do with this shampoo that was referenced earlier. Bentley has nanobots he wanted to get on Julie. Julie refused to swallow them. So what has happened is Yondu's put them in this shampoo that he claimed to Julie is to keep her from getting, you know, parasites in prison. But of course, the prison has a different remedy for that, which is that they shave people's heads when they come in. So he has put the nanobots in the shampoo so that as soon as they shave her head, it activates the nanobots. They don't have to make it through any kind of security because there's no security at the barbershop. Who would attack the barbershop in the prison? These little nanobots climb into all the machines and start shorting things out, including the clipper being used for her hair. So Julie ends up with a universally bad haircut, and everybody is very excited that the nanobots get in and get into the security system. Bentley and Anome and the Moloids are able to work everything out to where that they can see everything that's going on in the prison, and they're sort of directing Julie using the lighting system to get her to the cell where she needs to go to. We get to see some of Julie in the prison and some of Julie being very upset about her hair and the state of being in this prison full of evil aliens, several of which we see. And boy, Will did just an amazing job on these aliens. As you scroll through these pages in the prison, you'll see, like, my descriptions are just like, they're aliens. They're big. They're mean. They look scary. They look like, you know, the horrible, scary guys you meet in a prison, but even bigger and crazier because they're aliens. And we follow her and we find out that there's something else going on the ship. They found somebody in the prison who appears to be Reed Richards, their own mentor. And Alex is determined to go save Reed. Yondu points out that's not their mission. They're not here to save Reed Richards. If Reed Richards is in there, then who cares? That's not what he agreed to. But Alex and several of the others are determined not to leave their friend and mentor behind if he is really stuck in there. So they improvise a quick plan using Yondu's gun, which he is not happy about because that's his gun. Anome points out that the way the gun is calibrated, he couldn't possibly use it without liquidating his spine. And, you know, he's not sure what that has to do with anything, but Anome is sure that she can get it fixed up to where he can use it. And he says there's no way. There's no way he's firing that thing. Don't worry, she'll fire it for the first time. So, you know, we get sort of, Anome's going to fix this thing, and she's going to bust a hole in the side of the prison to get Alex and everybody in. All right. And here is where we get our introduction to Rebecca, who is, it would appear, a new character in this story. We'll get to that later. Rebecca is the source of this weird signal they're getting from inside the prison, which we'll find out more about later, what exactly this signal is, but it seems to have something to do with the Molecule Man. Julie is all set to rescue Rebecca, but Rebecca has no interest in leaving, it would seem. Julie tries to impress her with tales of having been an Avenger and being, and all that. And Becca's not interested in it. She says she's met Avengers before. It's not not a big deal to her. Julie mentions Avengers Academy, which she went to, and that, on the other hand, has some effect on Rebecca. She decides to be interested at this point and ask Julie questions about the world, and seems satisfied. There's a joke about the Spider-Mobile in here and how stupid it is. but in her, in Rebecca's knowledge of other worlds, the only one she's been to that had a Spider-Mobile is this one. So she, for whatever reason at this point, decides to let Julie help rescue her. We get her name, Rebecca. We jump back outside to the Moloids counting down to turning off the security in the prison. Basically, the plan is they're going to shut off the power to the collars and all the other security stuff keeping them in, everything but the cameras that they're using to look in on people. And then Alex's firing team here is going to bust in and get Reed out. And then once they get in and out, Julia gets Rebecca out. They're going to get in the ship and take off before they have to deal with security coming back on. Bentley has tagged along, even though nobody asked him to, because that's just the sort of considerate guy Bentley is. He's come all the way out here to mock Alex. Alex gets a shot in too here, though, because apparently, at least in his mind, Bentley has been mooning after Valeria since she left to go back home with her parents and the rest of the Fantastic Four. Bentley denies this adamantly. Julie is trying to get them into position to get out of here with the quickness once the electricity goes off. But Rebecca has some personal possessions left here that she wants to get to, because she's never she doesn't have much left from her previous life, and she doesn't want to leave behind what she does. The lights go down, and immediately Julie is out of her collar, when she is quickly disassembled with the super speed. And she agrees they're gonna go get Rebecca's stuff before they leave. Alex and team, we get a little aside from Anome here, who's sort of tells us a little bit about who she is and where she comes from, which was important to me to get with a character who hasn't had a lot of time to speak in the comics. Wanted to really give her a chance to tell her story. You'll notice the gun here is named Arkil, which is it's named after a character in the sort of cosmic Marvel universe. Does have some significance, but I'm not going to talk about what it is yet, because we're not there yet. Alex is getting ready to go and tells Bentley either, you know, help out or don't. He doesn't care, but they're going now. Then we get a little aside from Julie as she finally gets to flex her power muscles here. We see how fast she moves and how fast she flies. She's just zipping around these guards that are trying to keep up with her. She's running along the walls. She's carrying Rebecca on her back the whole way. We really find out, you know, from Julie's own point of view, who Julie is. And I really like these asides. They're a little bit contrived. They're a little bit what they are. But I wanted to give especially the characters that talk about here a chance to really say who they are. As we get the same thing from Alex next, as he's busting into the prison. Alex's in particular was one that, like, I think I wrote Julie's first, but Alex's was the one that I felt like was the most clever. As I was doing it, as the one that I was like, yeah, these are staying in, they're not going anywhere. So he's talking about responsibilities crushing him, feeling like he can't do it, but I think it's too heavy. Of course, he says, I'm the master of gravity. I am Alex Power. Nothing is too heavy for me. Which I feel like is one of those lines that as I wrote it, I was like, yes, I did it. That's it right there. Got it. Knocked it out. So, yeah, we get some great monster prison action. Everybody's fighting and having a good time in here. Alex is throwing people around with his powers. We get Dragon Man punching, Yondu shooting some people. Everybody's very upset at Bentley because he's not doing anything. He's just there bothering people. And finally, Bentley decides that he's going to take mercy and help them all out because they're helpless without him. So he pulls out a slingshot and some marbles. But of course, Bentley being Bentley, they're not just marbles. They're each one of them has different abilities, and they have different crazy stuff going on. This first one that he uses is a wormhole that, you know, this sort of elder god Cthulhu-esque creature sticks all these tentacles through and pulls this giant alien through the hole. We get Bentley's sort of statement of purpose here, which is about his him and his father and how they differ, and how both the wizard, his father, and Reed Richards are so concerned about good and evil, and he thinks that's dumb. He says good and evil are stupid. I'm Bentley 23, and I'm on the side of awesome. That's his deal. He's, you know, not good or evil. He's just in the chaos. He shoots another guy with the, a marble that shocks him and disables him. And Alex is trying to get to what he thinks is Reed Richards. Reed and all of his crew here have already gotten rid of their collars as well. And there's a couple of some bad looking dudes not letting him get to Reed. They don't want him to bother Reed because Reed is apparently their leader here. We get at the end of this one our introduction to the Maker and his own frightful four, which we're. I would stop and talk about all of them right now, but we're going to get introductions to them at the beginning of issue 2, which is what we're here to talk about in the first place anyway. But the Maker is not that Reed Richards. He's the Reed Richards from what we used to call the Ultimate Universe, a different version of the universe where the Reed Richards is not quite so good. All right, so we're going to jump into issue 2 here. So this is all brand new stuff on the day this podcast comes out. So if you haven't read issue 2 yet and you don't want stuff to be spoiled for you, don't keep listening, because there are definitely things to be spoiled on this issue. The first of which is Paco Diaz is amazing. Because I did something I thought was very difficult here, and it took a lot of trimming to get it to fit. But I wanted to talk about Reed Richards, and specifically I wanted to talk about the Maker and what makes him different than Reed Richards. So from Mr. Fantastic, the Reed Richards that we know. And I did it by doing a bit of a recap of the entire history of the Fantastic Four and the Ultimate Fantastic Four side by side, which is no No mean task. It's obviously not comprehensive, but it starts with the introduction of both Reeds, Reed Richards, Mr. Fantastic, and his father, Nathaniel, who is longtime readers of especially Hickman's Future Foundation will be familiar with. Nathaniel, he's a complicated guy, but a guy that really believed in and helped Reed to become who he is now. And then we get to meet the Maker's father. This Reed's father, his name is Gary, and he's awful. He's just a bad dude. He's abusive and terrible, and hates Reed for not being, you know, an athlete rather than praising him for being super smart. We get to see sort of how the two of their lives evolve. You know, they both become the Fantastic Four, but R. Reed, Mr. Fantastic, gets, you know, forms the Fantastic Four, and he gets married to Sue and has this, you know, fairly, this difficult but wonderful life, you know, with the Future Foundation and all these things. And that, you know, the Maker is, he goes through a pretty different thing. You know, his Sue doesn't love him. She's eventually in love with Ben. But, you know, she, if you've read the, all the stuff around, you know, the Maker and Ultimate Fantastic Four, he, gets Ben to, kill who he thinks is his Dr. Doom. It turns out to be, you know, not Dr. Doom, because it's very difficult to kill Dr. Doom. He has continuity powers. He tries to propose to Sue, and Sue turns him down. He then burns down his childhood home, killing both of his parents and staging his own death. It turns out he's not dead, but in fact become a supervillain in his own right, and is manipulating all these things that, you know, he's been working against the Ultimates, their version of the Avengers. Sue eventually discovers what he's done and confronts him. He does the only thing a nice guy like him could possibly do, and capture the woman he's in love with and torture her, which is then discovered by Sue's brother, who is, of course, the Human Torch, and leaves a nice burned facial scar on this on the Maker, which is what accounts for that giant crazy helmet that the Maker wears. And, you know, while R. Reed, Mr. Fantastic, is recruiting these kids from all around the universe and making the Future Foundation, the Maker is genetically creating and artificially aging kids to be the perfect breed of calls them the children of tomorrow, is sort of legacy. But then, of course, find out Secret Wars happens, and their worlds collide, and they go face to face, and the only way the world is saved is that Doom, our Doom, Victor Von Doom, pulls a bunch of pieces of the destroyed worlds together and creates a battle world to save the day. There's a, you know, Secret Wars is a great and long event, which is broken down in all of about three panels here. But, you know, ultimately, what we talk about here is that a lot of Earth 616, the world of this Doom and Mr. Fantastic, a lot of that gets saved because it's Doom's world. Not much of Earth 1610, the Ultimate Universe, gets saved because they don't have a Dr. Doom because, they do have a Dr. Doom, but their Dr. Doom has been, you know, in hiding and stuff for a long time. There's a lot of continuity there, but, you know, because this Doom is able to save the day, a lot of what we know is the prime Marvel universe, the 616, survives, and very little of the Ultimate Universe survives. In both of the Reed Richards's come face to face with Molecule Man, who is the one helping Doom pull all this together and keep the world afloat. And ultimately, there's a ton of continuity here, which is the real tricky part of this. Ultimately, Molecule Man chooses Mr. Fantastic over the Maker, or so it seems. He shreds the Maker into all these pieces. The trick of the Maker is that the Molecule Man then aids Franklin in rebuilding all of the universes and putting the multiverse back together. And there's a piece of each of them in all of these worlds, but also the Molecule Man leaves a piece of the Maker in each of these worlds. So there's been a lot of questions from people reading the first issue about how the Maker is specifically in Absolute Carnage and in Future Foundation at the same time. The answer is they're not the same guy, but they are. Because the Maker has all these different versions of himself that are scattered to all these different universes. But they're all connected at the brain. They all work together. He is all of these places at once and doing all of these things at once. And he can, because he's Reed Richards. He can handle that. So he is working all of these diabolical schemes at the same time. This Maker is not the same Maker who's in Carnage, but he is also doing those things. He is all over the place. And that is something that's going to come back in this story as well. We also see that in Fantastic Four, Owen got destroyed, disassembled, spread about the universe. And that's the mission of the Future Foundation as it stands right now, is to put those pieces of the Molecule Man back together. And the thing about that is Owen is the only one who actually knows about the Maker and what he is. Even once you discover that the Maker is bad guy, he just seems to be one alternate universe Reed Richards. The fact is he is not an alternate universe Reed Richards. He is the Maker, and the Maker is the Maker in every universe. They're all connected. They can all work together and work the same plans. He is incredibly powerful in that right. Let's give props to Al Ewing here for coming up with that and doing that. If you haven't read Al's New Avengers and then US Avengers, where they run into the Maker after Secret Wars and get to learn a little bit about where he comes from and what he is, go read that. It's very good. So we come back to present time, Largath 5, the prison planet. Alex is standing in front of this guy who seemed to be Reed Richards, but doesn't seem quite right. He has this big scar that Reed Richards never has. And Maker explains this way as like, oh, well, I've had this, I had this collar on. I haven't had the ability to get rid of this scar. I haven't been able to stretch myself. So it's just sort of been there. I recruited these guys to protect me. And we get a proper introduction to the rest of the Frightful Four here, which include Shi'ar Warbird. Aldi Vidua is the the short humanoid one in front here. We'll see her wings here shortly. And then we have a thing I created, which is a Massian Cronin, which is so Cronins are rock people. A Massian Cronin is a lava rock person. So they're sort of overpowered Cronins, rock people that throw lava. Because I felt like that must be a thing, right? If there are rock people, there have to be, volcanic rock people. I wanted him to have, well, hang on. We'll get to that in just a second. And then we have Kilrath of the Zinrex, which are snarks. They're the, if there are mortal enemies of the Power Pack, they are the mortal enemies of the Power Pack. They're creepy lizard people. And they're pretty well always evil. What I wanted to do here, what I thought was fun, was to play with the Fantastic Four archetype. Because the thing about the Fantastic Four is they're earth, wind, fire, and water, right? You got the Thing, who's earth. You got Reed, who's water, who's moves, bends. You got, obviously, Johnny, who's fire. And then you have Sue, who's air. She's invisible. And I wanted to sort of spin that. And that the giant rock monster here is the fire guy. The snark is the earth guy here. He's the bruiser. And then you have a flying person for the air. And like Sue, she is quietly the scariest of all of them. Because they're all bad. As we will see with Alti, she is not at all hesitant to kill some dudes. She is, a warbird. She fought for the Shi'ar. If we get a chance to do some more stuff with her down the line, I do want to discuss that she is a sort of a disgraced warbird, which is how she ended up in this prison. Alex immediately points out that snarks are not good. We shouldn't be working with snarks. And they don't really get a chance to go over this because they need to get out of the prison. Of course, Reed says, yeah, we can get out of the prison. Now that we don't have these collars on, I'm sure my friends here can help. Phyllis, I don't think I mentioned that the Massian Cronin here is named Phyllis. Which is a fearsome warrior name in her world. It's a shout out to Will's mother-in-law. We were trying to come up with good non-scary names for the scary lava rock man. We decided we wanted to go with a name that was not just not scary, but not scary in a very like mundane kind of way. And something you would not expect a lava throwing barbarian to be named. And we'll name it after somebody. And what we landed on was naming it after his mother-in-law, Phyllis, which I thought was fun. Alti is also named after Alti Fermancia, artist and generally amazing human being who's worked with me on a bunch of Marvel stuff. If you're not familiar with Alti's stuff, she drew the fill-in issues 6 and 7 of Unstoppable Wasp Volume 2 and I think the odd-numbered issues of the Hulk versus Thor Champions of the Universe story that I did. As well as having done a bunch of like X-Men 92 and she's done some great stuff. You should definitely check her stuff out. We named, Alti after her. Kolrath doesn't have a good story behind his name. I just wanted a name that sounded like a name for a snark. They all have sort of names like that. Kolrath isn't going to be around that long anyway, so spoiler, I guess. Okay, but they are
generally bloody and murderous in their approach on how to get out of the prison, as one might expect, and immediately Bentley starts falling in love with the scary bird lady. So we get back to Rebecca and Julie here. This is a fun scene. I wanted to get Julie her costume because she hasn't actually had a chance to wear her costume in earnest in the series yet. She came in this robe, so she goes back into the robe, and Rebecca is like, "Well, it's not a very good costume." Julie says, "Oh, no, there. This I like." Because unstable molecules have been a thing in the Marvel Universe since early Fantastic Four. That's their explanation for why costumes fit so tight all the time. Is that the shape changes. They're made of unstable molecules. I liked the idea of the FF having programmable costumes so they can change them to look like whatever they want to. And just basically change them up at any time. The idea of teenage superheroes being able to, you know, make and customize their own costumes at a moment's notice was very appealing to me. And so like she's basically just seems like she's wearing a robe. She hits the button on her shoulder and it turns into, Julie's costume, which we could see, Julie's ripped abs here as well. This is, something Will and I discussed is that, I feel like speedsters, male speedsters are almost always, shown as being like really ripped, having abs, being like, really in shape. Female ones are often not, even though in a lot of cases, like with Julie's previous costumes, they show more skin. So actually like making Julie fit and in shape here as somebody who, you know, moves very fast and burns a lot of fat, quickly. So a fun part of this design for me. I like it a lot. And we still have the horrible haircut, which I want to do something with. Hopefully we get a chance to. But didn't make sense for at any point while she's still, you know, in the prison running for her life to finish her shave. Rebecca still needs a chance to change here. So Julie decides to go out and hold off the guards while Rebecca gets into her costume. And we get to see one of my favorite things, which is a chance to really see Julie kick some ass. It's so rare that female characters, even, you know, good ones, get a chance to kick some ass unless they're like She-Hulk. But she has super speed. She can, you know, she hits this dude 100 times within seconds. He just goes flying backwards in the next panel. And she's, you know, ripping her way through these guys, throwing clotheslines. And, you know, in this last page, we see like she's disassembled this guy's entire weapon and pulled this other guy's pants down, you know, as she goes by. She's just that fast. You know, she moves at the speed of light. Nobody is fast enough to catch up with her, except, as it turns out, they have a central energy dampener, power dampener to, you know, supplement these collars in case they go offline. So Julie rounds the corner just as they're getting ready to turn this thing on, and she tries to get away. But here's the thing. She's running at light speed, and they hit the power dampener, and she suddenly can't move at light speed anymore, which causes her to fall very quickly, hurting herself very badly. Because, you know, when you're running at light speed and you suddenly can't move at light speed anymore, you're not going to be able to stand up and you're not going to be able to stop. So she goes tumbling and is in pretty rough shape by the time she lands. And she says specifically she's got broken bones. Here is our big page 12. They're coming for Julie. They're going to put the dampening collar on her. She's all alone, but then her backup finally shows up because Rebecca has her costume on for the first time. She shoots a dude, blows up the collar, kicks another guy in the face, and throws her shield. It's the, if you don't recognize it, that's the old shield that they used to use for a while back in the day when Captain America had a shield that was a hard light shield that he could throw. It was later inherited by Ricky Barnes. The girl without a world, Nomad, who has been missing for some years since her last apparent demise, and is Rebecca. So several people called that. I recognize that. You know, we put a lot of, like, who is Rebecca energy out there to try and get people guessing. And, you know, Twitter did what it does, and people got it figured out. So we get a cool, very Captain America, I feel like, introduction to Ricky, which I, you know, I made clear earlier, I love these little, like, who I am introductions. Yeah, no matter where you go, one thing remains true. Weak fighters, weak soldiers rely on weapons, not training. You take out their crutch, they go down easy. Me, you could drop me naked in any wilderness, and I'd fight my way out. I've been trained by the greatest soldiers of several universes. I've been called a lot of different things. Bucky, Nomad, Partner. My name is Ricky. My name is Rebecca Barnes, but my friends call me Ricky. I am a girl without a universe. I feel like we upgraded then a little bit. You know, they've done the girl without a world thing a lot. There's a story to this, which we'll get in issue 3. But apparently this universe is special to her. We get a nice little ready to finish this prison break, or did I interrupt your nap bit? She helps Julie up and tells her to call her Ricky, which, congratulations, everybody. Ricky Barnes is back. We'll say that was my idea. I wanted to do that from the beginning, but there is a very big why in this series as to why now she is back and what all of that has to do with anything. But we don't get it here. We get it later in the series. So stay tuned. But at this point, we get back to Alex, who's watching his prison break being escaped by the most unreasonably murderous group of bad guys that we may have ever seen in the Maker's Frightful Four here. They're just killing prisoners left and right. And an interesting little bit from Yondu here. And Dragon Man is notably worried by the inconsistency of the way this reed treats life. And, oh man, then we get this giant space alien drops from the sky with a sword stuck in its chest, and Aldi's back. Just murdered this thing 100 times her size by putting a sword all the way through it. I think Bentley at one point calls her a beautiful murder bird, which is what we were going for. She looks especially buff in this panel here. Aldi seems to have figured out that they've made a bit of a miscalculation in the amount of murder they're doing, and convinces Reed to call the others off and get them to the ship. And of course, Reed is ready to flush everybody out the airlock as soon as they get the ship. Meanwhile, Julie and Ricky are discovering that the whole prison is sending down to hell. Everybody's broken out, and there's a big battle royale going on. Ricky is not hesitant to fight her way out if she has to. They're having a debate about the morality of private prisons. And, you know, they both think it's wrong, but Ricky points out they don't really have time to correct this right now. If they're going to survive, they got to get out. We find out the rest of their plan is to get into the water supply and ride that out with the Uhari kids who are here to provide some help with that. Julie is nobly volunteering to stay and protect their exit, even though there is absolutely no way that in her current condition she'll be able to do much of anything. Ricky, knowing this, shoves her into the water. Just gives a cap like her. At the end, they take a swim out. we come back to the ship where Bentley is introducing everybody to what he sure is his new girlfriend in LT, the murder bird. This is maybe my favorite bit of conversation, which is Tong and Bentley here. Tong is very angry at Bentley for the implication that murder is a science, and Bentley implies that maybe Tong is just doing it wrong. Tong says she says, "I'm doing it at all. We're meant to be finding Dr. Richards," at which point the maker shows up. And is especially icky in this scene because that's what's demanded of him. He's an icky guy. And he's ready to get out of here, but of course doesn't know about Julie. Alex says there, you gotta wait for Julie to get back. They can prep for takeoff though. We get some mashed together bits here where Julie and Ricky are swimming their way out with the Uhari kids. Meanwhile, we get a development in the plot here. Alex is showing Reed his device, which detects when things around them are from a different universe. And it just happens to beep when he points it at the maker. Shows that he's not the Reed that they were after. He sends the Dragon Man, takes the kids off to go plot to take him out. Tong is only too ready to get this Reed who was rude to her and she knew wasn't the real Reed Richards. He wouldn't be like that. Meanwhile, Bentley is upset about the potential loss of his new girlfriend. much less worried about being murdered, much more about losing his precious murder bird. Julie and Ricky make it out, but the security system's coming online, which is this giant swarm of robots that can make basically whatever they need to get these guys. So they need to move fast, and Julie is in no shape to run at high speeds, but does it anyway so that she can get them out of there, and drags them by the arms to get out of there. Meanwhile, Maker makes his move, hearing the alarms go off, and decides to betray Alex and Yondu, but does not realize that he's about to be attacked by the kids coming back. Their war is interrupted by Julie, Ricky, and the Uhari kids literally crashing the party. And Ricky recognizes the Maker. And the Maker recognizes Ricky. He just calls her another Bucky. Just guess again, the same one. So it seems unlikely. We find out that the Maker has, at some point in the past, killed Ricky, or thought he had, which is where we're going to pick up issue 3 with that mystery of what exactly happened to Ricky. You know, the bit we got about Reed at the beginning of this one is what we're going to get about Ricky in the next one. It's actually longer and more complicated, if that's possible, but it's something I'm really excited about because it's a nice little like addition to the pieces of Marvel lore and ties a lot of little like things together in a way that I love it when other people do. And I'm excited to get the chance to play with all these pieces like that. So that's it for what we got right now. That's our prelude in issues 1 and 2. So if you're listening to this now, 2 is out and 3 should be out within the month, and you'll get and look forward to lots of great Ricky Barnes content next month. Thank you guys so much for listening, and thank you for reading Future Foundation. And I'm Jeremy Whitley. Come find me on Twitter at jrome58 and tell me what you thought of the issue if you haven't already. Thanks.
Forever.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. Engineered and mastered by Alex Sarche. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram at Forever Dog Team and liking our page on Facebook.